couldn't help but think, sitting over there last time Jim and I were on programs up in Tulsa a few years ago, and I was standing at the back of the room, kind of like Jim Hire counting the house. And a guy gave me a signal, and I started to turn away from these people to walk up to the platform. And the little fella said, "Where are you going?" And I said, I'm the speaker." He said, "You don't look much like a speaker." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry about that." He said, "Well, most speakers have gray hair and hemorrhoids." He said, "The gray hair gives you a look of distinction and the hemorrhoids a look of concern." My look of concern tonight is not for that reason. It's for the job I'm here to try to do. My name is Harold, and I'm an alcoholic. Because of God's grace through this program and by trying to apply the principles outlined in our steps, I've had nothing to drink since April 27th of 1960. I would be remiss if I didn't thank the chairman for the invitation down here, and also to tell you a little bit about how I feel. A guy described over at Lake Brownwood a few years ago exactly how I feel right now, and I want to share it with you. I'm real nervous. My legs are shaking, and my hands are sweating. My dentures are loose. And I need to go to the bathroom so bad I'm about to faint. But other than that, I'll try to get on with it. I have wanted to come here for a long time and tried every way that I could to get here. I've invited everybody that had anything to do with this to West Texas. With the idea in mind that they might sooner or later invite me here. And I always wanted to be here. It's kind of like the old story you've heard a thousand times, and it's not too spiritual, about the cowboys out in our country and the old farmer. It was on Saturday evening, and the boys had been drinking a little, and they were out in front of this joint, and this old farmer rode up on his mule, and one of the cowboys pulled out his gun and jerked the old farmer off the mule and said, "Farmer, can you dance?" And he said, "No." And he said, "Try it." And he started shooting, and the old farmer started dancing, and he was counting the bullets. And when it reached six, he reached over across that mule and got that rifle, and he cocked it, and he said, "Cowboy, have you ever kissed a mule?" He said, "No, but I've always wanted to." That's kind of the way I am here tonight. I always wanted to be here, and so I'm here. I don't talk a great deal about what my drinking was like because, as was said last night, I talk more about the last one. I came to this program in March, I believe, of 1959. Now, this was quite a little while before I quit drinking. But my wife and the fella who was my sponsor in the beginning, they tired rather rapidly, became willing to go to any length to get me sober, so they brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And immediately, I liked everything I heard. I liked particularly some of the things I saw. We do a lot of hugging and kissing out in West Texas. And they were doing a lot that night. And naturally, I assumed I was in the right place. I'd just come from some of that. And I thought I wasn't going to have to change things too much. And I sat in AA and I heard a lot of the misinformation that we still hear in this program. Take what you like. Work it any way that you want to. Believe in a wetback for your higher power. You folks don't know what a wetback is, I guess. That's a Mexican who swam the river who can't speak English. Many of these things I heard, and this is what I did. And I kept coming, though, to the program. Between every drunk, I was a regular attender. I'd go 25 or 30 nights and just get plumb bogged up in it. And then I'd get sick, and I'd have to be absent for a couple of weeks. But I'd come back. They told me to keep coming back. Nobody ever said to me, "Why don't you just stay here?" They just kept saying, "Keep coming back. You're gonna hear something." Wouldn't this be wonderful if this was the way Alcoholics Anonymous worked? You hear something. And I heard an awful lot of things. About as many at home as I heard in AA, because my wife had become very active in Al-Anon. And as Franklin said last night, I'll discuss that with you a little later on. But she learned this thing the Al-Anons learn. They call it detachment, release with love. I called it, "She don't give a damn anymore." I believe one of the greatest exercises in futility that I experienced while drinking was being gone for a couple of weeks and driving around and rehearsing and thinking and figuring it all out till I had it. And stumble through that door and nothing. By the time I got over the shock, I'd forgotten the damn story. And this is true. This is really what happened in our house. She was going to something called Al-Anon. Whatever it was, she was going, and every time I'd get back by the house, we'd have a little discussion. I know none of you fellas have ever gone through this, but you've been drunk for a couple of weeks, and you lay in there at death's door, and you finally stagger up to find something cool to sort of wet your flues down a little, and the little woman says, "Sit down, I want to talk to you." You can't imagine what in the world about. And very calmly and with a great deal of motherly dignity acquired recently in Al-Anon, she says to you, "Where have you been?" Just like that, you've got the answer. Nowhere. You gain a little confidence with that, you see, and then she spares you with another one. "What have you been doing?" "No problem now." "Nothing." "Have you been drinking?" "Two beers." " It is a long way to liquor store where I live. We went through this over and over and over. I'm happy to say I never changed my story. But things began to get real difficult. Real difficult. I might tell you just a little bit about it. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I made sure that you people saw my new Cadillac when I parked in front of your door. When I came back 14 months later, I caught a ride. I didn't live out on Silk Stocking Row. I lived about 3 or 4 blocks from the AA Club in a little rent house. I had ceased to be an independent oil operator. I was pretty independent, but all the oil was gone. I had been a successful man, measured by financial success. I had achieved at 35 years old everything I set out to do, and sort of retired to my hobby. For the next 6 years, I devoted myself totally to my hobby. One of them I had to give up when the money gave out, but I kept a drinking. There's one. But things were getting pretty bad about this time, and I began to see that as wonderful as Alcoholics Anonymous was, and as spiritual as I was becoming, I couldn't quite get the hang of not drinking. And they were beginning to frown on this. I had only, I felt, achieved a measure of success in AA. I'd only been drunk 7 times, which was 14 weeks. I had a par in 14 months. And the previous 14 months, I'd been drunk all the time. But this wasn't the way it worked, they explained to me. The important thing was that I quit drinking and come to the meetings. And I'd gotten half of that done. But the other half of it was just about to gobble me. So I went out to a liquor store close to home and got a case of whiskey. Like all drunks who are bums get a case of whiskey. I wrote a check. And the poor trusting soul let me have the case. And I waddled back into town and checked in a motel about 3 miles from where I live on the edge of town. And I went in and I locked the door. I don't know why I did this, because there wasn't a soul in the world wanted in there but me. There wasn't anybody following me. There wasn't anybody looking for me. But I went in and very cautiously locked the door. And lay down and started drinking. I had decided that since AA was not for me, and I had reached the point, and I knew I had reached this point, that I couldn't drink. I knew I couldn't drink. But I also knew I couldn't keep from drinking. This, to me, is the most hellish place I ever stood in my life. Was the day I knew that I could not drink and I couldn't keep from drinking. So I started emptying bottles. One morning, about 13 or 14 days later, I waked and the television set over in the corner was on and I could hear the noise, but there wasn't any picture. And this was unusual. I'd been seeing the pictures and not hearing any noise. And I knew it was a time after the programs were off, and I looked at my watch and it was 3 o'clock. And I got up to do the only thing I knew to do, and that was to take another drink. And I started into the bathroom there to get me a little branch water. And as I turned the tap on and reached over to get a glass, I looked dead into the mirror. And I saw, and I wish I could describe, but I cannot. I have been trying for a long, long time for me to describe what I saw. But I knew that I was all done. I knew that I had ruined my life, the life of my children and my wife, my brother and my mother, and everybody connected with me. I'd lost my business, I'd lost my home, I'd lost everything. And I knew it was my fault, and I knew there was nothing I could do about it. And I also knew that the thing that I was about to do, which was take another drink, was not the answer. I knew, for some reason or other, I knew it was not the answer. And I simply said into the mirror, God help me. And I set the bottle down there on the lavatory, walked out through the door and home. And I have not had a drink since. The next 2 weeks were not the most pleasant of my life. I hear people talk about today, convulsions and DTs and this sort of thing, and I've seen people had them, but what I had was sort of fits. Sometimes I was on the bed, and sometimes I was under it, and sometimes I was in the bathtub, and sometimes I was on the floor, but through all of this thing, down inside of me, I knew that I wasn't going to drink. And when people began to come and to help me sober up, as many of our well-meaning friends do, and I'm one who does this, I could not drink. I could not take any alcohol. I simply walked in whatever you do, scratch and itch and sweat, and that ugly word, puke. And I could do that from here at the back of that room because in our country they feed you orange juice and honey. And I was taking on every stop a full tank full, and then I'd round that back fence and unload and come back and get another tank full. But this is how I eventually got sober. And on the 27th of April, 1960, I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not really back, because, you see, I'd never been there. I had sat in the meetings. I had taken part in a few programs. Oh, no, just one program. I had been sober 30 days. And it was sort of the consensus of the opinion of the whole community that this rivaled, as a miracle, Lazarus coming from the tomb. And so they made me chairman on a Sunday afternoon and let me get my own program together. And I got a couple of three drunks that would say something nice, and the minister of my church, which is a long story in itself, but I got it all ready and set up on Saturday afternoon. I left town. And I didn't get back for a couple of weeks, so I didn't participate in any more programs. My minister was glad to come because I had been a deacon in his church for quite a while and served on the board of the church. I've been sober 11 years, and they've never mentioned the possibility of another vacancy on that board. And I really, this was one of the most terrible times in my life. In our church, you serve communion every Sunday, whether they need it or not. You serve it every Sunday. And it was my job as a deacon. One Sunday I'd get the bread bowl, and the next Sunday I'd get the juice, you know, that little rack with all them cups in it. This is the toughest job for a drunk that there is on this earth. I would stand there and it would sound like a bunch of Mexicans dancing with castanets, rattling. I never shall forget one Sunday. He was letting her out, you know, and he's nearly down to the Ubangis and the lower Slobovians, and I was a really rattling her. And he had to lay his hand over on my arm to finish his prayer to stop the rattling. And there's some old women that contributed rather heavily to the church and sat down right in the front, and they complained a great deal about me sloshing that juice. And some of them would be a little slow when they'd take the cup, you know, and I'd take her back. Can you imagine normal, intelligent people putting a poor old drunk in that position? But he was tickled to death when I finally came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been there ever since. And this time when I came to the program, I wasn't interested in the hugging and the kissing, and still ain't. And I wasn't interested in the bingo and the spring dances. I was interested in some one of you jokers that had been sober since 1888 telling me how I could live without drinking. That's what I wanted to find out. I didn't want to know what went on at the area meeting, you know, or what Bill had had for breakfast, or what the trustees was voting on. I wanted somebody to tell me how I could live without drinking booze. Just that simple. And you know, I ask a lot of people, and they started out again, "You'll be all right. I ain't got any hair on my head, because you'll be all right." Started the same thing. "You just keep a sitting there. You're going to hear something." A little old guy, not near as smart as me, came to me one day with a thing that's going to catch on in this fellowship one of these days. It's called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The most quoted and least read of any of our publications. You can get one now for how to relieve yourself of ingrowing toenails. If you'll write them, they'll send you one. And he said, "You take this book and you read it and you make up your mind about it, and then we'll talk." And I did. And I was confused, and I didn't know what they were talking about. But I remembered when he opened the book, he didn't go to chapter 5. This is all I had ever heard in AA. And I had just read chapter 5 till I knew it backwards and forwards, and I wondered where in the hell were the other steps. They talked about 12, but I couldn't find but 4. But read chapter 5. But he turned back the page of that book and started with the foreword. And he said, "You read it." And I read it, and we talked. And I read it again, and we talked. And I began to see some things for me in this book. I began to hear some things that were being said in the meetings that had been said all time, but they didn't mean anything to me. I began to talk to other alcoholics to tell them how I felt. All I wanted to know was how to live without drinking. I didn't want them to straighten out my finances or clean up my marital mess or help begin my ascension. I didn't want any of this. I just wanted to know how to live without drinking alcohol. And in the book, and I'd like to share with you some of the things that for me I have found. And what I have to say about it is my own opinion, as I see it and as it said it to me. But it made sense to me. A guy who had tried to get this program by hearsay, had tried to find in Alcoholics Anonymous by simply attending the meetings those things that would keep me sober. I had made many 12-step calls in the first 13 or 14 months I was in this program. And this didn't do it for me. And I know today why. I had nothing to contribute. I never shall forget. I'll tell this little story. My wife's not too happy about it, but I'll tell it anyway. I went to see one of my friends one day who had terrible drinking problem. He was a vice president of a drilling tool company, and when I got out to see him, he was just unloading a case of the sweetest thing this side of heaven, Jack Daniel's Black Label Whiskey. And I kept in my mind, I've got to talk to him about his drinking. But my eyeballs kept following that case. We got in his office, and I proceeded to tell him what I had done about my drinking as he took the lid off of the bottle. And right in the middle of me telling him how happy I was, up she went. And we got one of his colored people in a trailer and hooked a little house trailer on behind it and took that case of whiskey and went off on a little trip. And we never would have gotten back home except we were riding down the road one day at about 30 miles an hour, and he decided to see if it was cloudy. And he opened the door of the damn trailer and went over a fence and out in a pasture, and we finally stopped and picked him up and we had to come on back home. But this was some of the 12-step work I was doing. But in this foreword of this book, I found something that has stayed with me as long as I've been here. And I hope I stay here as long as I live. Our foreword tells us that we in Alcoholics Anonymous are many thousands of men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state. This meant a great deal to me. A hopeless state of the mind and the body. And to show other alcoholics precisely how we recovered is what this book is about. And that we hope for them, these pages will be convincing enough that no further authentication is necessary. This meant a great deal to me because I had read everything but this book. I'd read the red book and the green book and Beyond and Behind and Dr. Finkeldink's book and any book they handed me. But here it said, we hope these pages are convincing enough. No further authentication is necessary. And as I read this doctor's opinion, and there are many people here tonight far more capable about than I am in the field of alcoholism. Probably some from the medical profession. But for me, what this doctor said, when this book was printed 32 years ago this month, nothing any better has ever been written. His opinion of our malady was the thing that I was looking for. And he said to me in here that this malady that I suffered from occurred only in people like me. And as I read the phenomenon of craving he was talking about, I had tried many, many times to explain to someone that God-awful, insatiable craving for alcohol. And here it was explained to me. And when he said to me that men and women drink essentially because of the effect produced by alcohol, and that this sensation is so elusive that after a while they cannot differentiate the true from the false. How well this described what was wrong with me. How well it described. And in cases of irritability and discontent, until I could experience the relief that came from a few drinks. And this is what the guy who wasn't a drunk was saying to me. I could understand it. That the frothy emotional appeal, God, my poor mama, wore out her knees with frothy emotional appeal. I wasn't raised this way. What difference does it make? I was already raised and I was this way. I knew better than this. What I was doing to my wife and my... I knew all this. But the doctor said the frothy emotional appeal would seldom suffice. The message that would interest and hold these alcoholics must have depth and weight. And in nearly every case, talking about his experience, in nearly every case, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they were to recreate their lives. I read this 1,000 times. Everyone I knew had appealed to every trait of character I had for me to do something about my drinking. And you see, I had never made the decision that I had to make not to do something about my drinking, but that I couldn't do anything about my drinking. This was my decision. I had been doing all I knew to do about my drinking. But when it finally came to me that I couldn't do anything about my drinking, then the words of the doctor began to make some sense. And one more thought from him, and I'll hurry along. I hear a great many things today and read a great many things about this disease that you and I have, if you're alcoholic. There are people watching us, investigating us, experimenting with us, coming into our fellowship to find out what it's all about. But this doctor said, among the physicians, the general opinion is that the chronic alcoholic is doomed. They've never erased that, folks, from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Among the physicians, the general opinion is that the chronic alcoholic is doomed. And I believe this. If I believed anybody else anywhere on the face of this earth could do anything about my alcoholism, I'd be there tonight instead of Mont Eagle, Tennessee. But I have found in this program and through this book a way to live without alcohol. And in Bill's story, some very simple things, and as tragic a story as I've ever heard or read. But one of the statements he made that began to move me toward a more comfortable place in this program was when he said it was only a matter of his being willing to believe in a power greater than himself. Nothing else was required for him to make his beginning. I hung on to this, just being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Another thing that he said to me, and I didn't understand it then, and sometimes I don't now, but he said, I must turn all things in to the Father of light that presides over us all. I must. In his story, I found a great deal of my story. In his discussion of what happened to him and how he felt. And the great moment when his friend came and he realized there was an answer. And what happened to him in the hospital by doing some simple things. This made a great impression on me. I had heard in AA that Bill had a big flash. I never bothered to read it. It sounded good. And that he never took another drink. And lo and behold, I read the book and this wasn't the way it was at all. He says that we made a list of all of those that he had harmed and became willing to make amends to them. And that he would begin to practice God consciousness and to turn his life and his will over to his newfound friend. And then, he said, I felt lifted up. I thought it had happened without him doing nothing, and I was terribly discouraged because I'd been doing nothing for a long time and nothing had happened. But this wasn't the way it read at all. And I knew I had some things to do, and as I moved into the second chapter of this book, The Solution, I began to see these things so necessary for me to do. And this chapter said to me that the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than the body. And I believed this, and I believe it now. I knew that there was something wrong with my body, but my body couldn't drink without the mind being in full agreement. And yet it never occurred to me that the craving had anything to do with the condition of my mind. And yet it did, and here it was. And the book said to me, a much more important demonstration of these principles lie ahead of me in my home and in my affairs and in my business. And then it told me the solution that I believe as strongly today as I did then. It is a principle I try to practice. When it said in italics in our book, almost none of us liked the self-searching, the leveling of the pride, the confession of shortcomings that the successful consummation of this process requires. How true it was. I didn't like it. And sometimes today, I don't like it. I don't like the self-searching in some instances. I don't like the leveling of the pride to fulfill the condition of sobriety. But my book says this is the solution. So I must accept it if I desire sobriety, and I do. And I learn more about the disease that I suffer from in the chapter, more about alcoholism. I learned very definitely that this illusion and the idea that someday, somehow, I could drink normally and enjoy my liquor had to go. I knew that I wasn't normal, and this chapter told me why. It described in detail to me the disease that I suffered from and summed up the chapter with something I hope I shall never forget. And it seems many of our brethren and sistren around the country are forgetting this. At the end of this chapter, it says, once more, At certain times, the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against taking the first drink. And except in rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide this defense. His power, his help must come from a higher power. I hope I'm able to remember this every day. I hope that I am. Because I see today in our fellowship a great many people that I know don't want to be drunk. I have never been one who believes that I was drunk because I'd rather be drunk than sober. You didn't get drunk like I got drunk and rather be that than anything. I'd rather had the leprosy than be drunk like I was drunk. I'm not one who believes that our people get drunk because they quit coming to meetings. They quit making 12-step calls. I'm one who believes that at certain times I have no effective mental defense against taking the first drink. And my help must come from a power greater than myself if I am to survive this circumstance. And I see them today with 15 years and 17 years, and very recently in our country, 22 years of good, solid sobriety. Just as drunk as if they'd never stopped drinking. And everybody in the club, I didn't say group, everybody in the club knows why they did it. But I don't. And I've asked them. It has been my misfortune, I suppose, to make the call on three or four people with far more sobriety than I have. And see them just as the guy who never had this program. Maybe more so. And I don't know why they drink. And the guy drinking doesn't know why he drinks. But the book says, at certain times, you and I, who are alcoholic, have no effective mental defense against taking the first drink. The fourth chapter of our book, I think, was written for me. It's for the agnostic. I was not agnostic in terms of religion or spirituality. I was agnostic in attitude toward all of life. Mine was a show-me deal. And the booze showed me, I'm here to tell you. But I think this chapter explains to me better what I was than any other chapter in the book. When it tells me exactly what type of person I was, it tells me that I was having trouble with personal relations. I was depressed and a prey for misery. I couldn't make a living. I had a feeling of uselessness. It also tells me the type of alcoholic that I was. That when I honestly wanted to, I could not quit drinking entirely. And when I was drinking, I could not control the amount that I took. And I believe this because this was me. Exactly me. And I had no quarrel with this. I didn't need to do as suggested later on in the book, step over to the nearest bar and have a drink or two. I knew that when I was drinking, I couldn't control the amount that I took. And many, many times in my drinking, I honestly wanted to quit entirely. And I couldn't. And this was the type of fella this book was talking about. I need go no further. I didn't have to go to any other source of information. Simply go no further, and I'd found it. The fifth chapter of our book does tell me about the first four steps. It does tell me that probably no human power can relieve my alcoholism. It also tells me when the spiritual malady is overcome, I'll straighten out mentally and physically. I hear a great many people say you get well physically and mentally and spiritually. And I'm sure this is true for them. But the book says to me, when the spiritual malady is overcome, I straighten out mentally and physically. And I have found this to be true. No matter how badly I feel, how mentally depressed I might be, how physically tired, there is a thing in these meetings that appeal not physically or mentally to me, but spiritually. And I've never been to one yet that did not solve the straightening out. And I deeply believe this. I think it was written for people like me. The sixth chapter of our book is the action chapter of the book where we take the balance of our steps. And we're told in this chapter that our daily reprieve from drinking is contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I believe this to be true. It's not contingent on how well I feel physically or any mental catharsis I may go through that day, but simply contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. How is it with me right here? I learned very early this trip in AA that I had to get the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from between my ears and put it in my heart where I live. That no matter how much I knew about it, the reward was based on what I did about it and how I felt about it. And I could memorize the book and the steps and the daily word and everything else we use. But if it wasn't all right here, I wasn't going to do all right. And this daily reprieve contingent on my spiritual condition, not yours, gave me a great deal of relief because I didn't have to live anymore based on how well you were doing or what you were saying or what you were thinking or your opinion of me or what you thought my relationship with God was. Only based on how it was right here. And I began to pull AA down into where it belonged for me. I began to see my fellow alcoholic here, not here. And I didn't have nearly so many answers. Early in AA, I had every answer. In fact, I had some answers that nobody had asked any questions about. But very slowly they came here where I could live. And I learned that for every one of these things, there was an ending. And for every ending, there was a beginning. I could use my steps to end and condition any circumstance. And they became circumstances, not crises. I had lived all of my life. Everything was a crisis. I got to the point that it was equivalent to examination for a Rhodes Scholarship for me to go get the paper. It was a crisis because I knew I wasn't going to get back. Really, one time I went after my little boys a pair of shoestrings, and I brought them back, but I was 2 weeks of doing it. Always 2 weeks. I went after the morning paper, 2 weeks. And these were crises in my life. But gradually I began to see the circumstance and the answer here, not here, in the doing. And I believe love is in the doing. We heard a beautiful, beautiful expression of it here this morning. Then we come to our chapter that we all talk about, working with others. There are more opinions about this than there are people to work with. But the only way that I have known to do it is by the big book. And I've been severely criticized, yet I haven't had to sober up, so that's all right. But I was told in this book to burn into the consciousness of every man that he too could get well regardless of anyone. And that he would not stop drinking as long as he placed dependence on others ahead of dependence on God. And that he must be willing to live by spiritual principles and to stress the God feature freely. Oh, the criticism I got out in the cowboy country. Old boy sitting there, you know, been sober since before AA. If they'd have mentioned God when I got here, I'd have left. And I always wonder something real simple, you know, where the hell would he have gone? But I don't mention this to him because it upsets him. I've never had anyone throw me out of their jail cell because I mentioned what I believe Alcoholics Anonymous to be. I still believe our program of traction has to do with radio, press, and television. I don't believe it has to do with me. Any day that I believe I'm going to be attractive enough to bring somebody to this program, my ego's going to choke me to death. I believe I simply share with anyone what was shared with me just that way. And drag him, bring him, tie him, stomp any way to get him there. I'm not one who believes if you want it, come get it. Because if this had been the attitude of the people who came to me, I'd have died. I just couldn't ask you about sobriety. I could ask you about your business and how you was getting along with your wife. And if I saw you, how you were doing with somebody else's wife. But I couldn't ask you about sobriety. So it doesn't matter to me today whether a guy wants this program or not. The book doesn't put me in charge of whether he does or not. It tells me some simple things to do. And it tells me one thing simpler than all of them. That from practical experience, the surest immunity we know of from drinking is intensive work with other alcoholics. The book says, this works when all other activities fail. This works when all other activities fail. I believe this to be true. I believe this to be the basic of Alcoholics Anonymous's concept of sobriety, that it is one sober drunk from this program and fellowship sharing with one not so sober what he has received by the grace of God. This, I believe, is Alcoholics Anonymous. You can put it in all kinds of buildings, in books, in people, but I believe if we ever lose our ability to communicate with the alcoholic who still suffers, you and I'll die. This works, the book says, when other activities fail. The eighth chapter of our book is to the wives. I wish I had the time to say how I really feel about the Al-Anon and the Alateen program. If I had the time, I don't believe I could tell you. But there is a promise in this book, in this chapter, that to me, I believe, is the greatest single encouraging statement I have ever read in all of my life. When the wives of the alcoholic say to the wife of the practicing alcoholic, we want to leave you with the thought that no situation is too difficult or no unhappiness too great to be overcome. How about that? No situation is too difficult and no unhappiness too great to be overcome. I think these people, men and women of the non-alcoholic, do more with their program than you and I as alcoholics have ever been able to do. And as I saw Marcia standing here this morning, I thought about a 25-year-old daughter of mine and my drunkenness. 14 years old when I finally got sober. And what she was saying to me, I could hardly stand because it is true. And exactly in the way she told it, my daughter and I had the greatest of relations. Her mother was the fink in the deal. And I thought about this child in the many, many, many times over these years that I have made amends in whatever way I possibly could make. And yet I know they're not enough. In her years she spent in Alateen until she married were the most fruitful years of her life. And I thought about these two great big old boys of mine, bigger than I am. One married with two grandsons for me, and the other will shortly finish his junior year in college. They both can stand and look right over the top of my head. And I thought about them in Alateen and what they found there and what it did for them and what it did for their father and what a wonderful, wonderful relationship that has been my privilege because of the Alateen program. God knows I have never been any more grateful in my life than I was that I was at Mont Eagle, Tennessee this morning at 10 o'clock. You who are alcoholic like me and have children, think about it. How fortunate can you be? I might mention a couple of those grandsons. Guess who they're named after? The old babbling, tongue-chewing, stinking drunk. How fortunate can you and I be? And through this program, only through this program, are we given those blessings. Are those children able to stand and tell you and me the thing we love to tell the world? What we were like, what happened, and what we're like today. And the great thing she said this morning, that if you think your drinking does not affect your children, you done missed the whole boat. There is a blessing in this fellowship that those of us who have children are able to feel and be and move around in, second only to physical sobriety. And I'm grateful for the Al-Anon and the Alateen program. The 10th chapter of our book, the 9th chapter of our book, I think was written about me, the family afterwards, and it deals with a great many things. And I'll very quickly cover some of them because I got terribly spiritual early in my sobriety. Nobody at home was but me. I became Father Divine on Godfrey Street, and we had some real problems, but there's a line there that's the funniest damn thing I've ever read. The cessation of drinking is but a step away from a highly abnormal and strained condition. That's as nice as I ever heard it put. Sometimes I wondered what it was like when I was drinking. Who listened to all that? Who got all that conversation? But this chapter talks about some things that you and I need to know that our dark past in God's hands becomes our greatest possession. And this I believe. In God's hands. I like to never got it there. I toted what I was till it nearly killed me in this program. I could not get my past in God's hands. And I couldn't grow. And I worked and I worried and I prayed and I strained, but I just couldn't get it there. And then I discovered the book said to me that we grow by facing and rectifying our errors and converting them into assets. That's how we grow. I was trying to do it the other way. And finally, little by little, today, a great part of my dark past is in God's hands. And for this, I'm grateful. The 10th chapter is to the employer. And those of you who have had the magnificent experience of employing practicing alcoholics need this tattooed on your office wall. When I went back into business, it was my great pleasure and terrible misfortune to have 70 alcoholics on my payroll. And me and the payroll did not survive. A few got sober. But a few out of 70 is not many. But I did not practice the principles outlined in this chapter. Because of the great saying, I'm alcoholic, you know. They knew better than I did. There's no softer touch on earth than the fresh, sober drunk. He'll do more for you than your banker or doctor will ever do. And I did. I'm glad I haven't had to drink over it. But I've had to rearrange a lot of things. The 11th chapter of our book. I think it's all summed up here. The story of Bill and his drinking is reiterated again in part. And all of the things that are going to happen to you and to me are talked about. But the great vision here is described for me. We vision the great reality of the words of the book. We vision the great reality, the loving power of our Creator. And I believe this to be true. There are a great many wonderful, inspirational things said in this book. But there's one thing that I wish was on the meeting place wall of every group in Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe pull down a little of the praying hands occasionally and wipe away a few of the butterflies and hang on the wall these lines. No one has sunk so low or is too discredited to be welcomed cordially. I would like to see this in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like to see everyone who suffers from the disease of alcoholism know. No matter, as the book says, how far down the scale, he's welcomed here. Maybe if we'd use the arm instead of the prayer. Maybe if we'd go a little more often instead of inviting them. Maybe we'd do a little better job with this message we talk about in the program. If this message for me isn't that I am sober today by the grace of God through this program and must share this with anyone that wants it, then I don't have a message. If I must exclude or pick and choose or turn away from anyone who wants this program, then I do not have the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And somebody quoted last night this great thing that you nearly hear the fluttering of the wings about abandon yourself, and I believe it. But there's one word in there that appeals to me. It says, we trudge. We don't hop, skip, and jump, and play leapfrog, and throw spring flowers. We trudge the road. It takes time. We got to look where we're going. If you're trudging, you ain't walking on level ground. You're going a little uphill. And it takes time. And you need to see where you're going. One of the things that I love, and I share with you because it explains to me and you to me, that I'm able to stand here tonight and thank God, my father and above all my friend, for lifting me out of the life that I was in, for standing me up and letting me know that life's never over until he lets go. For this program of truth and concern for another, for our book and our fellowship and our love for our brother. Our thanks we offer, but in deep gratitude I pray for this gift of life, ours for today. God bless you.